This is Monitor on WRRS. I'm Charlie Van Sant. It's great to have you with us. Monitor is a show about radio, broadcasting history, amateur radio, AM, FM, shortwave, and more. Today we'll look at the beautiful 1940s actress who helped revolutionize communications and why the loss of a U.S. submarine continues to haunt the U.S. Navy. First up today on Monitor, the overlooked radio heroine. The Life, Work, and Inventions of Hedy Lamarr by Georg Bissala.
She was the best-looking woman that ever lived. I don't know whether it's true, but you hear things.
She is this perfect underdog crime fighter by night story.
She was such a big star. She seemed so untouchable.
She was so ahead of her time.
She said more than once, "My beauty is my curse." And by that she meant people never got past her face.
There are
maybe you have not heard of Hedwig Eva Maria Kiesler, 1914 to 2000, but I feel certain that you are all familiar with that gifted inventor's screen name, Hedy Lamarr. If not, you should definitely watch the film Bombshell, The Hedy Lamarr Story. Hedy was born in Austria, the daughter to Gertrude Lichtwitz from Budapest and Emil Kiesler, a banker from Lemberg, now Lviv. She rose to stellar fame in the USA as a film actress and, more to the point here, as a multi-talented inventor. The Guardian brought it to the point in 2018 when it claimed Lamarr's story is one of a brilliant woman who was consistently underestimated. Quite. Early promise. Growing up in cultured, cosmopolitan Vienna of the early 20th century, what else but theater, muses one of her biographers, Richard Rhodes, and by extension, motion pictures would a bright, pretty, single-minded Viennese girl choose. Hedy enjoyed some early success in Vienna, and what was then Czechoslovakia. In the year Hitler came to power in Germany, she starred in the then-controversial film Ecstasy, 1933. Controversial because of its brief nudity and the first known faking of a female orgasm in cinema. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, Meg Ryan. Benito Mussolini, it is said, kept a copy of the film. Adolf Hitler, by contrast, banned it on anti-Semitic grounds. However, both had come to dinner at Hedy's, as did Gustav Mahler. Lamarr left her first husband, Fritz Mandl, an arms dealer and Austro-fascist, to live as a Jewish émigré in Paris and London. She may have remembered many dinner table conversations over wartime technology. She was eventually offered a Hollywood contract by MGM chief Louis B. Mayer. A slew of exotic adventure movies followed, among them Algiers, 1938, Lady of the Tropics, 1939, Boomtown, 1940, H.M. Pullum, Esquire, 1941, and White Cargo, 1942. She was the Austrian Empress Elizabeth, and she rose to ultimate cinematic stardom in Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah in 1949. Unfortunately, she turned down the leads in both Gaslight, 1940, and Casablanca, 1942, both of which would have arguably have cemented her standing in the minds of the American public even more. Both of the female leads there, of course, went to Ingrid Bergman. Her final movie was The Female Animal, 1958, and she also produced a couple of films herself, not, it has been said, too successfully. Did you know, by the way, the mansion used in The Sound of Music, made in 1965, belonged to Hedy Lamarr at the time? Although she earned very large amounts of money during her career, she lost her fortune along with her production company. She died in Florida in 2000. Lamarr has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame at 6247 Hollywood Boulevard. Frequency hopping. As far as technology was concerned, Lamarr was self-taught. It is said that she often settled down to some inventing after a grueling day on a film set. Her hobbies and inventions were wide-ranging, including music boxes, traffic lights, more streamlined aeroplanes, and effervescent cola tablets, to name but a few. She was particularly fascinated by an early Philco 116 RX 10-tube radio, by its remote control, the aptly named Mystery Control, and by mechanical player piano rolls. She enjoyed significant support in these ambitions and activities, notably from aviation tycoon Howard Hughes, who lived from 1905 to 1976, who provided her with a set of experimental equipment, and the composer and polymath George Antheil, 1900 to 1959, who used player pianos a lot in his work. By the outbreak of World War II, Lamar found out that it was possible to deflect remotely controlled missiles, such as torpedoes, by simply jamming the radio signal and altering the weapon's course. In response to this, she proposed a method of secure radio communications, a frequency-hopping technique which would make jamming or tracking impossible. Lamar understood that by transmitting radio signals along with rapidly changing frequencies, U.S. radio-guided weapons would be more resilient to detection and jamming. Rhodes claims that Hetty's idea, although original, might be derived from what she learned about the 18 frequencies of the German glide bombs of the period, mechanical player pianos, and the Philco radio music box remote control. In the creative ferment of Hetty's imagination, these strands must have fused subconsciously into her invention. In her frequency-hopping system, the sequence of frequencies would be known by both the transmitter and receiver ahead of time, but to the German detectors, their message would seem like gibberish. No jammer could detect it because no German codebreaker could decipher a completely random code. With the help of George Antheil and others, Lamar built a prototype for a machine which coordinated a mechanical piano player with radio emissions. Two synchronized piano rolls were used to activate the transmitting radios, and the machine used the rolls to change between 88 frequencies. Art had truly met science. Wartime stimulus, according to the Los Angeles Times. Lamar's invention came about because she was keenly aware of the coming war. She was glued to the newspapers, reading all the stories. When German submarines began torpedoing passenger liners, she felt, quote, "I've got to invent something that will put a stop to that," unquote. As the war progressed and her wartime fundraising activities gathered steam, Hetty approached the then-new U.S. National Inventors Council, stating, according to her biographer, that she knew a good deal about munitions and various secret weapons, some of which she had invented herself. The National Inventors Council had its roots in the sinking of the Cunard liner Lusitania on the 7th of May, 1915, by a German submarine. The ship sank with the loss of 1,134 lives. A few months later, in July 1915, Thomas Edison wrote to the New York Times calling for ideas and practical suggestions, either from the service or from civilian inventors, to be submitted to the Navy in order to help with the war effort. In a 1997 interview with fellow inventor Carmelo Nino Amarina, Hetty revealed that irrespective of the impetus of impending war, she had at first conceived of the general idea of a remotely controlled torpedo. She had then thought of radio waves, taking her inspiration from the first ever wireless remote for a radio, which looked rather like an old-fashioned telephone dial. Eventually, her and George Antheil's frequency-hopping machine was granted a patent under U.S. Patent 2,292,387 on August 11, 1942. It was filed using her married name, Hetty Kiesler Markey. Hedwig became a naturalized citizen of the United States at age 38 on April 10, 1953. Delays and successes. Notwithstanding such early activities, the U.S. Navy was reticent at the time. The military took her idea and, as a recent documentary revealed, used it eventually. Meanwhile, Hetty Lamar was advised that she would make a greater contribution to the war effort as a pinup in films such as White Cargo, 1942, made to distract the troops and by selling war bonds, rather than as an inventor, and war bonds she did sell. to the value of $343 million, in fact. Consequently, ships were not equipped with Lamar's invention until the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. By then, her system, previously rejected as too complicated, spread like wildfire. Its most well-known application today, spread spectrum communications, in particular Bluetooth, as well as the development of new technologies for the prevention of the interception of telecommunications. The patent, not just for a radio-controlled torpedo, but for a wider secret communications system, helped to solve the problem of enemies blocking signals from radio-controlled missiles during World War II. It involved changing radio frequencies simultaneously to prevent enemies from being able to detect the messages. While the technology of the time prevented the feasibility of the idea at first, the advent of the transistor and its later downsizing made Hedy's idea important both to the military and to the cell phone industry. It is estimated that the current market value of the technology is a staggering $30 billion. Out of the limelight, she was married and divorced 6 times, famously on one occasion. She sent her body double to a divorce hearing. Her later life was marred by family problems, drugs, cosmetic operations gone wrong, and legal troubles on various fronts. In April 1998, for example, she sued the software company Corel Corporation for using her photo on the cover of its product, Corel Draw. In spite of having been in the limelight for decades, Hedy Lamarr suffered increasing isolation, a fate she, arguably, shared with many other radio heroes, such as Nikola Tesla. A documentary, Calling Hedy Lamarr, was released in 2004. It featured her children, Anthony Loder and Denise Loder DeLuca. It is hard to avoid the impression that the film played on her tendency to conduct almost all of her affairs over the telephone later in life. In 1997, Lamarr and Antheil received the Electronic Frontier Foundation Pioneer Award and the Bulby Nass Spirit of Achievement Award, and some very belated recognition for her work. This was followed in 1998 by an Austrian award. An exhibition, Homage à Hedy Lamarr, was organized in Austria in 1999. Conclusion. Hedy Lamarr's life has inspired stage plays, books, novels, films, and even a graphic novel. She never did have the opportunity to use her patent, and the legal protection afforded by it ran out in 1959. Consequently, she never did receive any money from it, in spite of writing to the U.S. Navy about this in 1969. Humiliatingly, before she became a U.S. citizen in 1942, her patent was even seized as alien enemy property. The Navy, meanwhile, had used the frequency-hopping mechanism in ships and sonobuoys. A sonobuoy is a relatively small buoy, expandable sonar system that is dropped, ejected from aircraft or ships, conducting anti-submarine warfare or underwater acoustic research. The great inventor's name also lives on in GPS systems, MilSatCom military satellites, and surveillance drones. I have found no better quote on the amazing screen goddess and technological trailblazer that was Hedy Lamarr than one used by Pamela Hutchinson writing on women and representation in The Guardian in 2018. Quote, if Lamarr's full story had been told while she was still working, or if she had ever played a woman as brilliant as herself in a film, perhaps the revelation that a star had brains as well as beauty wouldn't be quite such a, well, bombshell. And again, that's the story from the July 2019 issue of the Spectrum Monitor, Overlooked Radio Heroine, The Life, Work, and Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, by Georg Bissala. The USS Thresher on Eternal Patrol, by Scott A. Caldwell. All sailors face risks, have always faced risks, but none more so than submarines. The words of Dr. Robert D. Ballard. The USS Thresher, SSN-593, was an icon of the United States Navy and was often used in recruitment posters. She was regarded as the most technologically advanced submarine in active service designed to hunt and engage Soviet submarines that patrolled the deep North Atlantic Ocean. Her loss on April 10, 1963, shocked the entire nation. The subsequent inquiry raised more questions than answers in light of the confusing radio transmission with the submarine escort vessel USS Skylark. Underwater communications were subjected to temperature and density fluctuations that often deflected and distorted the amplitude of the sound waves. The geology of the deep ocean floor adversely impacted the quality of the signal transmitted by the Thresher. The signal transmitted was bounced off the ocean floor, causing a reverberation or a continuous echoing sound at the receiver. This often resulted in garbled communications and potentially delayed the escalation of the search for the missing submarine. The death of the Thresher. The distinct sounds of the Thresher's death throes were received and recorded by the highly classified sound surveillance system, the SOSUS, a network of underwater hydrophones located at strategically important sites that terminated at the Canadian Naval Station HMCS Shelbourne. They were principally designed to detect the running machinery of Soviet submarines and track their precise position at long ranges. A number of breakthrough discoveries on the characteristics of propagation paths of sound through the water column were essentially the driving force behind its development and deployment. An SOSUS hydrophone array, codenamed Fox, was located 30 nautical miles from Thresher's last recorded position and detected the underwater implosion that marked the death of 129 crew members. It identified Thresher's acoustic signature on low-frequency plots. Unfortunately, there was no recording facility on board Skylark to document the signals received from the Thresher, requiring the submission of her logbook and written testaments. This information was collated by the Command Oceanographic Systems Atlantic and indicated that a high-energy and low-frequency noise disturbance was detected. It was comparable with a frequency range that could have been made by the underwater implosion of Thresher's hull. Most strikingly, it was timed at 09:18 hours, consistent with the messages received. There were also two additional indications of disturbances that extended from a time range of 09:09 to 09:11 hours and from 09:13 to 09:14 hours, which may have originated from the blowing of Thresher's ballast tanks. It is alleged the original SOS LOFAR-GRAM data was destroyed by the SOSUS Evaluation Center on the pretext that the data was more than 5 years old and quite extraordinary. It was deemed that another submarine would not be lost on routine duty. The date of destruction was scheduled for May 22, 1968. Ironically, the date that the USS Scorpion, SN-589, was officially declared as lost. The main operational function of the SOSUS network was the detection of noisy diesel engines that propelled Soviet submarines. The Soviet naval bases in the Barents Sea and the White Sea provided the resources that led to an increasing number of submarines that entered the North Atlantic Ocean, systematically altering the strategic balance of power. The physical superstructure of the SOSUS system has led to a number of vulnerabilities and fallibilities. It was common practice for Soviet trawlers to cut cables, preventing a continuous flow of transmissions, creating a high-tech game of cat and mouse on the high seas. The radio men who operated the SOSUS were accustomed to receiving a number of bogus signals. They were originally labeled as Jezebel monsters, and further investigation led to the conclusion that they were low-frequency signals that originated from blue and fin whale vocalizations. The Cold War necessity of maintaining a superior command and control capability changed the operating policy of the U.S. Navy, which was enforced to cultivate an even closer working relationship with the oceanographic community. The search for USS Thresher, a detailed analysis of LOFAR-GRAMs from a diverse number of SOSUS stations, ranging from Argentina, Newfoundland, and Antigua, resulted in a time difference fix on the approximate location where the Thresher's hull imploded. This time difference enabled the development of a 4x8 nautical mile ellipse with the inclusion of a major axis that oriented from 40 degrees to 220 degrees true. Breakdown in operational communications. Naval communications are strategically vital in modern warfare. They are considered as the voice of command by which naval command makes known its operational policy. During the subsequent inquiry into the loss of the Thresher, a number of questions centered on the perceived delay in reporting the true significance of the breakdown in communications. At 0940 hours, the operations officer on board the Skylark requested authorization to transmit an official message informing of the loss of communication with Thresher. However, this was initially refused by Skylark's commanding officer, Lieutenant Commander Hecker, who concluded that it is too early. The following official message was transmitted by Skylark. It was very noncommittal and hinted at a possible communication system malfunction. Quote, unable to communicate with Thresher since 0917. Have been calling UQC voice and CWQRBCW every minute, explosive signals every 10 minutes with no success. Last transmission received was garbled, indicated Thresher was approaching test depth. My present position is 4143 North, 6457 West, conducting expanding search. The message was transmitted as operational immediate and took a considerable amount of precious time to be received by a duty operator at New London. In terms of naval urgency, there were two other forms of higher priority that related to detection and engagement of hostile vessels. The loss of communication with the Thresher was not yet deemed as an emergency. The Skylark was an auxiliary support vessel, and she lacked the sophisticated technology that was routinely installed in combat vessels. The Skylark had to depend on the turn of the 20th century technology in the form of Morse code, and to make matters more stressful, the atmospheric conditions were extremely poor, and the operator at New London had to request a number of repeats. Finally, after approximately 1 hour and 58 minutes, the message was successfully transmitted in full. In accordance with routine operations, Skylark had conducted a radio communications check with New London earlier that morning. It's quite ironic that when the communications system was generally needed, it was found clearly wanting, although by then it was already too late to assist Thresher and her crew. However, in retrospect, the message did not convey to operational commanders based at New London the full extent of the information then available, nor did any of Skylark's subsequent reports include such additional information. It was essential to report the manner of Thresher's last garbled message and the possible detection of an underwater implosion. Most shockingly, Thresher's last messages were not fully disclosed to higher naval authority until the navigator of Skylark boarded the USS Blandy with transcripts of her communication logbook. They were subsequently examined in minute detail by the Deputy Commander Submarine Force U.S. Atlantic Fleet. At the subsequent inquiry into the disaster, it was established that the operations officer has suggested the inclusion of additional information that revealed the compelling nature of Thresher's final communications. However, it was ultimately rejected by Lieutenant Commander Hecker, who failed to include any reference to the message experiencing minor difficulties, or more importantly, the final communication that was garbled. No agenda of Thresher's sea tests were provided to Lieutenant Commander Hecker, making communications an essential aspect of Skylark's assignment as an escort ship. The only means of communication was by underwater acoustic radio. However, Skylark was equipped with a QHB-A-type sonar with a working range of 3,750 yards. Its limited range meant that no sonar contact was made with Thresher during her depth dive tests. On April 12, 1963, the recently established Court of Inquiry began the process of securing material evidence that would acquaint them with the chain of events in relation to Thresher's transmissions and her last known position. The existence of this information was provided by messages transmitted from the Blandy detailing the context of the last UQC communications. Lieutenant Commander Hecker was clearly under considerable strain and pressure during the Navy Court of Inquiry. He instructed his attorney to request that the court withdraw his evidence as a party to the inquiry in light of the negative press and adverse public opinion that branded him as a scapegoat. Radio equipment on board Thresher. It's extremely difficult to establish what communication equipment was operated on Thresher. The U.S. Navy is still extremely sensitive and reluctant to disclose information on the equipment. Some files are still classified as secret. Based on research and correspondence with military communication experts, it's possible to speculate that Thresher was equipped with the following. An ANURC-32 single sideband transceiver was built by the Collins Radio Company. It was a manually operated radio with the capacity of transmitting signals over long distances. It represents the principal form of communications on U.S. Navy vessels due to its service versatility, reliability, and powerful performances. Its regulated out was set at 500 watts and operated on a frequency of 2 to 30 megacycles. This provided a comprehensive range of communication functionalities consisting of single sideband transmissions and reception of signals on upper sideband. In addition to general SSB functions, it was capable of AM, carrier, plus upper sideband, CW, continuous wave, in other words, code, or frequency shift keying. The principal role of the FSK mode was for sending radio teletype and facsimile signals. An R390A HF communication receiver. The R390A was essentially a general coverage receiver that was designed and mass-produced by the Collins Radio Company and issued to all branches of the U.S. military. The popularity and success enjoyed by the R390A was the direct result of rigorous research and development that was undertaken by the U.S. Army Signal Corps in 1954. The total number of sets produced was in excess of 55,000 units. USN Communications in the early 1960s. The radio man, when operational at sea, was widely regarded as a jack of all trades in the communication business. His operational duties included a little of everything, such as manning the radio telephone circuits, copying fleet broadcasts, or operating teletypewriter equipment. Radio men were also expected to keep their communication system in full operational condition and perform routine maintenance when required. The late 1950s and early 1960s witnessed a period of drastic change in communication systems that were operated by the U.S. Navy. Many frontline vessels had single sideband circuits and a militarized version of single sideband equipment installed. Further, research and development focused on the role of satellites to meet the unique requirements of providing highly reliable communications between dispersed platforms. In August 1962, the USNS Kingsport became the first seagoing vessel to operate a communications network with an orbiting satellite, SIMCOM-2. In 1965, the USS Midway and USS Canberra developed the concept of communication during fleet exercises utilizing a number of satellites, most noticeably SIMCOM-2, SIMCOM-3, and the ANSSC-2 terminals. This unique system employed super-high frequencies for uplinking and ultra-high frequencies for downlinking. Conclusion. The legacy of Thresher still looms large within the U.S. Navy, despite the passage of over 60 years, and her legacy lives in promoting safety governance. A national campaign for a permanent memorial has finally been granted approval. Its costs will be covered by a fund of $60,000 from the submarine community and family members of her crew. Again, that is an article from the Spectrum Monitor magazine, The USS Thresher on Eternal Patrol, by the author Scott A. Caldwell. Resource material came from the Spectrum Monitor magazine, YouTube, and the Monitor tribute pages. Thank you for joining us. I'm Charlie Van Sant, and this is Monitor on WRRS. Thank you.